Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and we are sitting at the International Culinary Center, and today my guest is Charles Fan, the really much lauded chef from San Francisco. You probably know him from The Slanted Door, because he was awarded in 2004 the Best Chef of the Pacific by the James Beard Foundation. He also was inducted into the Who's Who of Food and Beverage at the James Beard Foundation in 2011. But out in San Francisco, he is really, really considered a favored son. In 2010, he got the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society Standing Ovations Award. He got the 2010 Ivy Awards. In 2005, he got the Anti-Defamation League Achievement Award. We've got to talk about that. In 2009, the co-chair of the Vietnamese American National Gala, the fifth anniversary. He's in New York doing the New York Food and Wine Festival, and he's got a beautiful new book, Vietnamese Home Cooking, which I'm just salivating over. I don't even want to sit here and talk to you, Charles. I want to go home and cook. But welcome. Welcome to New York. Welcome to the International Culinary Center. I'm sorry we're not at Roberta's today, but happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I mean, you are really one of the legendary chefs of San Francisco, and I have eaten Slanted Door and the Ferry Building, gorgeous restaurant. I think in a lot of ways groundbreaking, very creative, beautiful architecture, everything, but we're going to get into that. Let's delve into your past. Tell me, where were you born?
Born in Vietnam, a little town called Da Lat in the Central Highland. It's about an eight-hour drive.
From Saigon?
From Saigon. Very slow driving. Mm-hmm. Winding road. Left in 75, part of the Vietnamese exodus.
Oh, how old were you?
I was 13. Got on a boat and got to the Philippines and Guam. Stayed in Guam for about almost two years.
Wait. We can't go this far. If you were 13 and left in 1975, what were let's just do the food memory of the war years that you were there. What kind of food were you eating in that very tough time?
Well, I was born in it, so you just have curfews, and so I don't look at it as being tough. I don't like July 4th, like loud bang noises. That's the only kind of remnants of the war that drives me crazy when I see fireworks. But other than that, great food. We didn't travel much. It was hard to travel during the war years. Mm-hmm. So you kind of stay put. But where we come from, there are a lot of French restaurants because it's a resort town.
Yes.
And my mom speaks a little French, and we would go to French restaurant, the street food. Back then, Vietnam weren't as global, as open, so all you eat is Vietnamese food.
Or French.
French.
French. If you're going to get stuck somewhere and only had two cuisines,
right.
You could do worse. You can't do much better.
Yeah, and the Chinese were there, for thousands of years, so it's an influence. But you'll get the taste of some, let's say, hui food, And of course, there's not a whole lot of northerner at the time.
So you were in the central part of Vietnam.
Right.
And there's a northern cuisine and a southern cuisine
and a central cuisine.
Tell us a little bit about the differences in the cuisines there.
Well, they're huge. I mean, it takes 2 hours to go from Saigon to Hanoi. So it's equivalent like L.A. to Seattle. So you can imagine.
In a plane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can imagine the type of differences. Internal influence, and obviously Hanoi is closer to China and Yunnan. Like they eat dill and turmeric. In the south, you got the delta, the river, the Mekong. They're different, and back then they weren't travel. In the central region, it's considered for a long time the capital of Vietnam, all the kings and queens, emperor, food. So
was it a royal cuisine in the central part?
Supposedly, yeah. I mean, you don't... nowadays in Hue, you'll have... You know, definitely you see the old tradition, the dresses and so on. But the street food is really...
So what did your mother make? What are some of your favorite childhood dishes?
Well, Mom was a busy businesswoman running, you know, she was really, I mean, Dad was loading up warehouses, but she's running the cash register at the general store.
What did he do?
They had a general store, like selling dry goods and, candy, cigarette, coffee, and start drinking coffee when I was like in fourth grade, I think. And mostly you would have made and help you go to the market and buy everything fresh. Mm-hmm. But the street food, and it's just always my memory. I remember there's one stall right behind my mom's shop, and it was like crispy noodle stir fry, crispy noodle with a kind of soggy sauce, and sitting there in the monsoon rain, pounding in this army tent. You can just feel the vibration from the water hitting the tent, and you're just waiting for your turn to get this food. It's just, and I'm trying to, you know, write down some of that memory in the book, and because for me, like eating a crepe in Vietnam, it, you know, they don't have gas stoves, so it's charcoal, so it takes a long time, and you would sit there waiting to your turn to get your crepe, and meanwhile there's a wonton vendor filling in the gap, and they're like co-marketing. you know, basically you pay one price, but you get the soda guy is one guy, the wonton guy is another guy, and the crepe was just great.
At home, did you have people, you had cooks?
Yeah.
Who wasn't your mother, you came from a fairly wealthy family and that had servants. So did you ever hang out in the kitchen and learn to cook?
Oh, that's all I hang out. I mean, that's all we do. I mean, it sounds kind of opulent, but it's not really, because Mom's working 16 hours a day. She have a whole crew that goes with her into the store, and they work 14, 16 hours a day. And sometimes they don't even eat lunch, and I'm living at the warehouse, so I'm not like a block away. Mm. And the cooks will make food for everybody. And back in those days where most of these young people work for us, they actually board with us, and there's a whole floor that they live upstairs. And they would go home, see their family once a month of some sort, so everybody would make food. And sometimes they get into fights and
so they were making their own food.
No, there's a company cook.
Oh, there was a company cook that made,
like, imagine almost just like a stagecoach. Like, it's not that outlet, right. Because it's just like it's just work, and the men would eat one meal, the women would eat another meal. They don't sit together because there's so many of them, and they were different level, and we would during the day eat with the women, and we don't eat with the men and all the kids. And I remember my little brother went to the market, got a fish, and they killed it, and they took a plastic fish, throw it into the pot, you know, and Larry said, oh, he's crying. He said, the fish is not smiling. I mean, we don't have refrigeration. There's no, I think we got our first propane stove was 1973, 74. So, you know, you can see the maid slaughtering the chicken.
But you had those long pieces of charcoal, and they would go in a charcoal.
Yeah, fuel was very difficult. You know, like the kitchen was always black, and there's charcoal, and you start a fire, you don't turn on.
Did it flavor the food, the charcoal?
Yeah, and it's
So did it change when you went to propane?
No. I think, you know, they still grill with charcoal.
Yeah.
And I think boiling water and it makes it a little easier.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. It's just like people don't really use refrigeration.
Mm.
The whole connection of food. And you go to today, just 6 months ago, in the market, and there's no refrigeration with the meat. It's just killed that day, get used up that day. There's no styrofoam. There's no expiration date. So, and people don't realize that. They see the wet market and they think it's gross, but you smell it. You don't smell rotten food.
Right.
The fish is just that day, and there's no preservatives, there's no freezer.
Well, the greener we get, the less packaging we want.
Right.
You heard in Germany now they're peeling bananas and putting them in plastic so people don't have to peel. I mean, it's crazy. But anyway, let's get back. So then you left on a boat,
got to Guam.
How long were you on the boat?
I was in the ocean for about 2.5 months, 3 months.
How many people were on the boat?
About 500. Then moved. Well, the first one was the rough one. We were like bopping around about 7 days. It's supposed to
because
be
because you didn't know where you were going.
Yeah, well, the guy said he knew what he was doing, but he doesn't. And, you know, most of these guys never. It just go up and down the coast of Vietnam. Once they get into international water, they lost their navigation. Then we were picked up by a Malaysian patrol boat.
Uh-huh.
Then we end up just in the Singapore Harbor, and no one wanted to take these refugees.
Yeah.
And there are 300,000.
How were you eating on the boat, and was there enough food?
Well, the first round, 7 days, was on rationing. You have a little ball of rice and a cup of water. Then once we got to Singapore, they just bring one of my favorite things is just these sardine and tomato sauce and these canned. And some of my friends just freaks out and they won't eat it. For me, every now and then I would just sneak it in and bring it, you know, heat it up with some hot rice and soy sauce. My favorite thing. And Spam.
That's they gave you on the...
Yeah, and for me, that was just great memory. And But some people are... I know a few friends that come from the same boat, and he's just like, I'm not touching that stuff. I hate that stuff so bad. Because we're eating that like day in, day out. Got to Guam.
Wow, Guam is far away from Singapore.
Yeah.
And it's out in the ocean there.
Yeah.
Right?
So we got to Guam, 300,000. At the time, you can get on the plane, they'll send you to the other camp in the States.
Oh, they sent you by plane?
Well, once you got to Guam.
Yeah.
We got from Singapore to Guam was on a ship. The Singapore
to Guam.
Yeah.
That's a long trip.
Yeah, they don't want to take anybody. So what happened? They gather all the little boat and put on a big ship with better navigation and hopefully. And they just send you through to Guam. It was a giant refugee camp, 300,000. And they start putting the refugees all across the United States, like Camp Pendleton and upstate New York. And that's why, you know, Minnesota. In fact, you watch.
So that's where you wound up?
Well, we chose not to go. You can get on a plane or stay. That's the only choice you have.
Oh.
Well, actually, in Guam, in Singapore, you have a choice to go back to Vietnam, go to Taiwan, United States. And once you get to Guam, you can either go to the States or stay in Guam.
I see. So.
And Mom thought, if we're going to be homeless, we're going to be somewhere warm.
Yes.
Not Minnesota. Nothing against Minnesota.
No.
But so Mom was just... You know, didn't you know? You don't have money. You don't speak the language, and the whole idea of the government giving you money is just that doesn't exist before. So,
right.
Anyway, we stay in Guam, and
Guam is quite tropical, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like Hawaii, not as developed. It's a coral reef island, and so we got to San Francisco. Well, we stay in Guam for about 2 years. Then we got family sponsors out of the refugee camp, and my mom and my dad worked for them. And my dad was a janitor for an office building. Mom was being a housemaid.
That must have been so difficult after everything they did.
I know. My dad did it twice. He was wealthy in China. He left. That he lost all that, and now second time again.
Oh.
And, you know, when he passed away about 7 years ago, and he was half his age. And I'm trying to imagine, like, 40-something to be in the middle of the ocean with 6 kids. It's just amazing to think through how these guys, you know.
You come from good stuff.
Yeah.
survivors.
So we came. We have friends in San Francisco, and we wrote to them, and we promised the sponsor we stayed a year. We stayed a little bit more than a year. Came to San Francisco. They wrote a letter. Back then they weren't phone or email. And they said, this beautiful apartment we got here, it was a Tenderloin. We got two studio for 11 people.
Oh, my.
In the Tenderloin.
Oh.
And
which is not the great neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, for people listening elsewhere, the Tenderloin's not the best neighborhood.
I remember coming here at 4 in the morning and with bright light and people out in the street and the ladies out in the street.
The ladies of the night, yes.
I was just shocked, you know. Guam was, get dark after 9. We stay there. It was kind of hilarious. Dad knew this was not good. Mm. And within 2 months, the building manager set the building on fire. I forgot to tell you. When we were in Guam, we got situated in this little beautiful stilt house on the beach and, wonderful setting.
Oh.
Biggest typhoon came and blew the house away. And then we're back out in the street again.
Oh, no.
We got onto the Red Cross line. They were, and we weren't as fast. We were kind of slow and getting free clothing. And you can get the voucher. And we got there, and they only had size 46 and 36. Mom would buy them and try to shrink them down. It was just hilarious. And we got to San Francisco, and we left the Tenderloin, and he got a place in Chinatown, and he got a job with an English pub. And this is where my restaurant story sort of comes in. He was a janitor there in 1977. In 1978, I got a job bussing table. And I remember going there, like, I never knew how to carry a plate, and I used to, hug all the plate against my chest. And with an English gentleman, an English pub right by Chinatown, and he taught me how to service. And so from 78 to 84, I worked all the restaurant, nightclub, and I worked 2 or 3 nights a week.
And so I was started as a waiter?
Busser. Yeah, back then you have to be ruffle and captain in the 80s.
Right.
So I was in nightclub, and I was exposed to all this food. Like high school, I buy Calistoga. Kids would make fun of me who... they said, this is a guy that buy water, I remember, having...
What was your first thought? What was your first impression of American food when you landed?
Oh, I love it. In fact, I always liked cooking. Mom was working all the time, so I start cooking dinner at 8th grade, 9th grade. I come home, I make meals.
What kind of meals were you making back then?
First Chinese, mm-hmm. Then I start, I remember watching Jack Papan. And learning how to cut an onion. And today, I still think of him every time I cut an onion. And I remember, watching, making puff pastry. And that's, I watched his show the most. And I always liked, back then KQED was really the rage of cooking show. And the
great cooking show.
Yeah. And I always follow all the cooking show.
So, but you actually went to University of Wisconsin?
Mm-mm.
No.
UC Berkeley.
Oh, UC Berkeley.
Yeah,
I got this wrong.
I went to Mission High. I really wanted to be a potter, so I was throwing pot and just not like a normal kid, because I was 2 years older also. My mom had fixed my age, so I was 2 years older than most kids.
Oh, I see.
They fix the age in Vietnam, so I don't go to the military. Uh-huh. I want to be an artist. My dad was just not having it.
You being an artist.
Yeah.
He wanted you to be a businessman.
Yeah. Engineer, doctor. My mom worked for a hospital. So, in fact, got an invitation to apply to Cooper Union and all this great school.
Wow.
And I had passed it up, and I ended up settling with UC Berkeley to do architecture. And I told him, oh, yeah, it's an architect. So supposedly, it's legitimate, right?
Yeah.
So I went to school studying architecture. And by then, I was really, exposed.
Because you had an artistic passion, and architecture was sort of a compromise with your father, as opposed to you just loving architecture.
Yeah. And it turns out to be really a great move, because I think my first class with a giants, Joe Estrich of the Bay Area Architect.
Really?
And he was, he decided to take a freshman class that year. Now, last year he did it. It really changed my way of looking at the world. And I was just thinking about architect in a fancy suit and fancy marble and glass. And this guy was just in Birkenstock and humble. And he's talking about building something beautiful with simple material. It's all about scale and light. It was just a lecture class. He's just almost like this old disciple. You just hang around and listen to him. There's no homework. It was amazing. Twice a week, and he would take around the campus and go up to some of the Maybach home or the Green Brothers and sit and talk about space. And it really changed my view towards a lot of things and how I approach, you know, solving problem. Because I was applying to Cal Poly, and everybody says, you know, it's a great architectural school, but they're focused on, you know, very technical stuff. And Berkeley is a lot of theory. It's not good. But we chose Berkeley. And I think it was just me. You know, really helped me see. And I did not know I want to be a cook. And so during those years in Berkeley, I was working in the restaurant. And I started seeing this idea of building a place, a modern space with design and sensibility, but Vietnamese food.
Okay, we're going to take a break here, which I don't want to. This is so fascinating. But we're going to take a break and we'll be back in a minute.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. We support Heritage Radio Network because all you folks listening are so genuine, so dedicated to serious food, so much a part of what this country needs to strive to become. People like you are few and far between, and it's obvious to us at Fairway that we've got to stick together. Our desire is that the word gets out about Heritage Radio Network in its support for serious food, foodstuffs that offer memorability and timelessness, authenticity and rarefied quality. This country grew too fast to have established any degree of a heritage. Europe had centuries to develop one. America has not. Heritage Radio Network serves to hasten the evolution of a society that often appears coarse and uninterested. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
So we're back. Welcome. You're listening to Chef Story, and today's guest is Charles Fan of The Slanted Door in San Francisco. And we're hearing right now about his leaving Berkeley and the influence of architecture school and how it comes together with your food.
Well, also Berkeley at the time, I was kind of exposed to like the Monterey Market and the Berkeley Bowls. You know, Alice Water, you know, Chez Panisse, I couldn't afford, you know, at
the
time.
Did you ever go there?
Not when I was in school. I mean, it was just way beyond my, my budget. but I was living in a co-op, and I didn't realize this. I ended up, like, cooking for five guys in my dorm room at a co-op. You know, we have kitchen, we cook dinner, but I did a separate meal, five-course meal. So I was around the Nouveau Cuisine and all these the continental cuisine, the English restaurant. I worked for a guy named Sam Duval who had a Creole sort of 1920 but it was kind of modern at the time. It was just really, Cafe Royale was really hot in the 80s in San Francisco. And so I was in the food scene, just from the peripheral of serving. And I remember drinking cappuccino and latte, you know, before Starbucks, literally. And there's a place right by my high school, Just Dessert, and they would make fresh croissant. I would ride my bike there, like, way before class and, you know, have coffee and croissant in New York Times, like, in 10th grade. You know, it was just really odd, you know. I was really into food, liked to eat. And
well, you know, San Francisco, just being there gives you that kind of exposure.
And I wasn't really thinking about cooking as a career. The whole chef thing was never entered my mind. But during the school and subsequent years, and I third year in Berkeley, I came out to New York and worked for a firm out here, living in, you know, 129th and Claremont.
Really?
Yeah.
So you did that for you were working for
architecture? Well, I went into this whole protest, community organizing, try to protest they have fee hike, and I got into the whole Berkeley thing. Then I had to drop out of school that year because I didn't go to my classes because I boycotted. And so I finished that, and we had the biggest protest. And then I, to kill the rest of the year, I moved out here in the mid-'80s.
Why New York?
Oh, everybody got to come to New York. New York is it.
All right, I'm a New Yorker.
Okay. You know, New York, and, you know, the subway was, you know, rough. Back in the mid-'80s.
It was all graffitied.
Yeah, they still hadn't got the new train yet. Yeah, a new train yet. It used to have a lot of fire garbage down the train track.
Yeah, 129th and Claremont is not a great neighborhood either.
So. Well, it was. I went to the Columbia Housing, got some apartment up there. Then went back home after a year. Mom had a sewing business, and I took over. I had to go back and help, and I didn't finish school. Oh. Ran the garment business, started a clothing store, started designing clothes. It was just anything I can get my hand on design. Like, even though I'm not really into clothes, but it is what it is. And
how old are you at this stage?
20-something, 24, 25.
All right, so the food thing is just still
I just spent a lot of money in eating food. Yeah. So got the garment business, grew that really big, then lost it all, went bankrupt. And, you know, it was savings and loans. You know, we had a lot of contract
In the 90s?
Yeah, late 80s. And
90s, people, the savings and loans.
Yeah, people didn't pay us, and people filed Chapter 11.
Yeah.
And a couple years later, we're out. And so... That's when I really, I could have just, and then I start traveling, go back to Vietnam in 1992 for the first time. Mm-hmm. And 92, then I was going to travel, and but I decided to stay and didn't want to move to Hong Kong. And
you stayed in Vietnam?
San Francisco.
Okay. Wait, so I didn't, you were traveling.
I was going to get a job in Hong Kong. You know, looked up some alumni, Berkeley alumni architecture firm. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, it was really cool. 1992, going back to Asia, and like everybody's my height. You know, there's no top people there, and it's, I was like, wow, man, this could be cool. And the food was just amazing. But I didn't want to leave my family, so I decided to just get a job, and I got a job selling software.
in San Francisco.
Yeah, and selling into post houses, and you know, this is right in the. This is before the internet, before, you know, and it was just Unix graphic system I was selling. And we were dealing with emails and with Eudora.
Charles, you have done a lot of living before you even... I've never met a chef that had such a background. So, wow. So how long were you doing that?
2 years. I was running around, you know, selling to, like, post houses, trying to get ABC to buy this little piece of software to make transition. Or Broadway Video, and I mean, coming into town, or giving a demo at the NBA National Broadcast Convention, great time. But it was just that was just a little time. Like, I didn't want to own any business because it was really stressful during the sewing year. But I always had this idea in my head that this restaurant thing, and I think literally 10 or 15 years that I see this picture of this modern design place, but serving, you know, sort of Japanese, Vietnamese food, like mm-hmm. 6-7 item. It was always in my head. And, you know, but at the same time, it didn't bother me that I never cooked in my life, like professionally. And so the company that I work for, the software, we got some venture money, then we went bankrupt, and you know, Internet Explorer wouldn't even exist yet. This is like Netscape, right? And then I was gonna again start traveling, and I was gonna work for a company that sell SGI. SGI was this big computer company that does graphic, and they were really hot. And I was gonna get a job there and move, do international sale.
Did you make the jump to restaurants?
Well, at that time I was 30-something already, 33, and I say, I better not mess around anymore. I should do this, something I've been in my head. And I got about 20 grand, and I said, I'm going to open a restaurant. It's time, you know. And so it's been long enough. It was 2 years since I had my last business. And I start looking around. I'm unemployed for about 8 months. I was living in a loft in downtown Oakland, and I would ride my bike and have like 3-hour coffee in Berkeley and go by Market Hall and think about what I want to cook that night. And I had 10 people over that night and having a party. Then we were going to do a little small place in the Tenderloin. And I didn't have a lot of money, $20,000, not much money to open a restaurant.
Not at all, especially in San Francisco.
Yeah. And 8 months of trying, looking at one ad, trying to buy businesses, and finally found the space on Valencia Street. And it was just a box, and it wasn't even a restaurant. I was crazy enough to just dive in, not knowing how much money I got. And anyway, I got some money. Finally, I took everybody's money in the family, you know, whatever cash they had.
For the working capital?
Yes.
Once it was opened?
Yeah, yeah. So I think we end up with $60,000 total.
Still,
yeah.
That is nothing to open a restaurant, even in the 90s in San Francisco. Whoa.
So we opened with credit card, and I think by the time, and it took me a year to, like, I didn't have enough money to buy tile. I would do all the work myself, and but I saw the space, and the rent was cheap, and I promised.
And you brought your architectural eye?
Yeah. So I remember making a deal with the landlord. I said, look, here's some deposit. If I can't get my permit, you can keep it. And I just have a sense of business and locking. I'm like, everybody's looking at this space. And I just stole it underneath with everybody else. And my rent was $2,000 a month. And I didn't know how to build it, you know. So, but I just saw one thing at a time. We built it. We opened a year later. That year, that's when I met my wife and we got married. And she, you know, we opened in November. She moved back from Thailand in December. And by then, I think it was like $140,000 we spent, you know. The rest came from credit card. It was like 20, 30 credit card.
Wow.
And that was the first year. And the goal was to sell $200 a day to make ends meet. I was living with my mom. I didn't have rent.
So $200 a day, gross.
That was the goal.
Yeah. And so what happened in the first year? How much were you making?
I don't know. We really opened in November, and Bauer reviewed us back then a day in March, you know, then just nonstop.
After that. So finally, little good luck enters your family that you don't have to struggle.
Yeah.
I am so happy. It's redemption.
Well, it, you know, but at the time it was just me and my wife and my brother.
After Bauer, what was the business before and what was the business after the San Francisco? Michael Bauer is the restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and it can change a life, right?
Yeah, but we were getting, like, you know, I remember putting this photograph of noodles steaming, and it says, coming soon, a modern Vietnamese restaurant, The Slammed Door. Everybody thought it was some Bollywood movie. And it has that Bollywood movie look. So people were like, you know, I remember we set the date and tried to open. I only got six items. I couldn't even get six of them out. Like, it was nine. I think I got about four of them out. Like, I had to postpone another week because I don't know how to cook this. And everything was just so backed up. I had a test run. And people's, you know, it was just, the timing was just perfect. It was just, this neighborhood was like a little diamond in the rough. Then all of a sudden, like, this dark street, all of a sudden you got this modern, hip-looking loft space, the original location. And we did it really.
How did you come up with the name?
I didn't want it for people to stereotype the restaurant, because I know that if I say Vietnamese and people are going to want, you know, free tea and I want to serve, you know, European wine, I want to serve European dessert, you know, so, and I want to have this kind of hip thing to it. A friend thought the door was slammed, but the whole wall was slanted. It was a 1950 building.
The whole wall was slanted?
Yeah, the whole facade was canted, you know,
oh,
it's not
I
parallel.
See. I see. The ordinary person see that, or was that your architectural eye?
No, nobody sees that. And at first it was kind of edgy, a little race kind of connotation, but I was like, well, since I'm Asian, I can do that. In the beginning, I got a lot of grief from some Asian group. It's like, you're making fun of us. And I say, hey.
You got the Anti-Defamation Award, so you obviously overcame that.
A year into it, we're pretty much, you know, following the sort of Alice method of six simple thing buying. A year into it, I pretty much switched to mostly
the
organic.
The Alice method?
Alice Water.
Oh, Alice Water. I thought maybe in Hue.
No.
Alice Water's method of what?
Sustainable organic food, but not a lot of items.
Okay, six items, you said?
Her, yeah, 10.
Is that what she says? 6, 10?
I don't remember what she said, but that wasn't her menu back then, so I was copying her thing.
Yeah. And so you were, so was sustainability and organic something on your radar, or was it just naturally what you did?
Well, the problem is, like, I know what good food is. Like, yeah. I eaten good chicken, and I was just getting sick of the food that I buy in commodity market.
Right.
So the more I dig, the more I need to go to the organic route and mm-hmm. gotta go look for farmers.
Did you work with farmers?
Yeah.
Because the ingredients, were they readily available for you to do your Vietnamese?
Yeah, because, I was like really cheap and like I would go to the market myself in the morning and try to buy a half case of beans, and I would look at it, I won't pay for it, and they wanted me to fill out form, I don't fill out form. I want to pay cash only. Some of these bigger companies, like, you don't have an account, we're not going to sell it to you. So I was buying off, like, retail markets, you know, and I was so anal back then. I would only buy enough beans for one day, like green beans.
Because you didn't have the money or because you believed in buying stuff every day?
I believe in buying stuff every day, like Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I was a little crazy. I wouldn't even prep anything a day ahead because I didn't have any kitchen experience. Like, I won't pre-cook my chicken like a lot of some Chinese restaurant. Uh-huh. Like, for me, you just cook like you cook at home.
Right.
And
how many people were in your kitchen at that time?
Two. Just me and one more lady, my aunt.
Your aunt?
It.
Yeah. Well, no wonder the food was so fabulous. I didn't have it back then, but
and
that's
my
what
brother
everybody
was waiting
wants.
Table, you know.
Your brother was waiting the table.
Yeah, and it was
how many seats?
It was like it was 90 seat, but we weren't very busy, you know.
In the beginning.
Yeah. So I didn't even have a dishwasher. I would just leave a pie on. I wash it twice a week. I mean, twice a day. You know, night, you know.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to have to take another break here, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about how the empire grew. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is Charles Fan of The Slanted Door in San Francisco. We've just been having a wonderful time talking about this early days of The Slanted Door. Well, it's an amazing story. How did the empire grow? What was the growth like after that, and what made you grow bigger?
Well, we just got busier and busier, crazy. Like, Friday night, we'd do four turns, and we don't...
With 90 seats?
Yeah, four turns, wine, beer. And by then, you know, I had brought in people to help me, like, our wine director. Like, I didn't know wine. I don't know wine at all. Like, I didn't have time. And we were really setting some new ground. Like, Mark Ellenbogen, first 6 months, we started doing all Riesling. And no one was doing Riesling. And it was 100% Riesling, you know, a German, Austrian list. And it was small, single page. And we were like, there were a lot of new ground. Like, we were serving expensive Chinese tea at like $180 a pound oolong that was serving at $5 a pot. Now, mind you, in 1994, 95, the Ritz-Carlton only charges $2 a pot. And most teas are like 50 cents, like Lipton, right? Mm-hmm. And here I am, my spring roll was $4.50 for the appetizer, and my tea was $5. Because the math just doesn't work at 180.
Right.
I mean, this is...
Did people order it?
At first, they didn't. I mean, the people, some of them are like, I get free tea. But once you start ordering, they see how amazing it is. Mm. You get multiple brew. Mm. And it was really... And it was, I just, like, 3 years prior to that, I just discovered all these amazing tea. You know, this is time, just for the first time, Roy Fong from your Pure Tea Court and David Hoffman from Silk Road, they were just starting to import because China was not open at the time. And all of a sudden, you get these stuff that cost more than the stuff you smoke, you know? So, I don't know how much smoke you took cost, but I think it's cost a lot. $180 a pound for a tea is just a lot. You know?
So you actually discovered those in San Francisco through these importers?
Yeah.
So did you have a sort of a tea sommelier?
No, just me. And we would, you know, really anal about, you know, how many steeping time, what kind of pot, you know, keeping, you know, we would rinse your cup hot before we bring it to you.
So tell me how, you know, we have a lot of chefs out there. How do you say, how do you distinguish your food in your restaurants compared to other chefs? Asian chefs, not necessarily any.
Well,
what's distinguishing about the side door?
My method is really about bringing a little piece of Vietnam, a little history and culture to you. So I don't try to change it. But I do try to make it good. So if I learn a dish in Ho Chi Minh City, like this beef called shaking beef, I remember having it in 1992. And I changed a little bit using filet instead of flank steak. I cut a little bit bigger, make it medium rare, because I know most folks here don't like well-done beef. But also the way we serve the food is family style. We don't like to have, you know, like an 80 all plated stuff. Mm-hmm. We're using, you know, beautiful ceramic. First year, we went to Thailand, Chiang Mai, and have all the ceramic made. Mm-hmm. And this is not even pressed. These are thrown. Mm-hmm. Thrown solid on platter from Chiang Mai. Design was very important, you know. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have money to do a lot of things, but I spent like $140 for the chair, because that was really... Mm-hmm. And I would make the tabletop out of plywood and cut it myself. Mm-hmm. So where we can really push the envelope in design, both food... But
you also introduced wine in these teas, so you were taking a different kind.
Well, the accoutrements all there in terms of the service, the wine glass, you know, because I come from fine dining, so so I was doing, but the food, I did not follow the food that I learned, which is all plated. Like, I hated the mashed potato touching my fish, you know. I thought just I don't even like to eat that way. And people compose these plates. It drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. And I like flavor that are just, you know, in parts. And I eat through each dishes. And I don't like them mingle together. I mean, the only time I ever let food touch each other is Thanksgiving, you know, the cranberry and the, you know, but that's designed to be touching each other. But not when you do a banquet or Chinese banquet, when you have a fish and you shouldn't have your meat on the same plate.
Right.
We were changing, and the service style was very different. It allowed us to really pump through the volume. Crazy little tiny restaurant, that $140,000 restaurant, by the 7 year, we did $3.9 million.
Wow.
It was just crazy. I mean, we were like selling $10 entree. I mean, it was a lot of volume. We were like, it was so crammed, and like literally you don't even move in the kitchen. You just turn around and pass the dish down. And by then I had trained, you know, my dishwasher now is my walk guy. And it was just this whole family of people. Working like crazy.
So then how did you move to a bigger place? Why did you move?
Well, we couldn't stay there. The lease is up. The family is squabbling, the landlord family. And again, I was just like a refugee. It's just like your place is burned out again. Yeah. Like, I can't stay there.
Yeah.
And now we have, you know, a $3-4 million restaurant, and we can't stay.
Yeah.
And I say, well, then they end up, I convinced them to sell the building. I don't even know how I did that. I don't even know how I got the loan. It was just crazy. And I bought the building. I was building a house in Napa. I was laying some tile. I do a lot of stuff myself, laying mosaic tile. And this bank just came and said, oh, we're not giving you a loan because we just had to shut down. And they say, we're shutting down. And your loan is no longer working. And I was like, it's just 10 more days. And now the
landlord... To buy the building.
Yeah. There's closing in 10 days.
Oh, my.
Now the landlord said they don't want to sell. Now, after they realized that it was all that squabbling, now they want to take it back. And I had to find money in 10 days.
Wow.
And it was crazy. I literally asked my customer to loan me IOU cash. I got... $2 million worth of cash.
From your customers?
Uh-huh.
Oh, Charles, you're amazing.
It was just nutty, you know? It was nutty. I couldn't get a bank loan in 10 days. There's no way. And
so they became your angel investors?
No, not even an investor. There's no investor. Just an IOU. I pay you back in 60 days. That was it.
60 days?
Yeah.
Whoa.
They wouldn't even paper. Well, wow. I know I can get the loan once I have
in
time.
In 60 days.
Because
yeah.
I already got one loan. But
boy, that was trusting. How many people launched you in?
Oh, I can't remember. I mean, I have one.
More than five?
Yeah. I mean, I have one big one. Yeah. I have one big one, but like it could be $20,000 from one, $100,000 another. It was just nutty.
Fabulous.
But
what a story.
But I don't, you know, when you're back against the wall and when you got nothing else to lose,
you
just do what you can, you know.
And
I remember my mosaic tile's crooked because when I got that phone call, I was so angry. I left the mosaic tile and it got stuck. So every time I go in that bathroom, it reminded me that loan that, you know. And we just, you know, take one problem at a time.
Right.
Then we moved to, then we had to move out because the building needs to be fixed and all this problem. And I was like, okay, let's just solve one thing at a time. We found, you know, this restaurant just went out of business, it was dot-com bust. We moved to Brandon Street. It was never planned. We went over Brandon Street, and our sales just jump up again. It was just another new challenge. We had cocktail night introduced to the menu. So I go around, I ask people in the industry, come and help me make cocktail, you know. And and that's when Thad at Bar Agricole and these guys started working for me. They were working at Fairlawn. Eric Atkin, now my bar director, and they're all friends, and the guy came out of Yale. But, you know, these kind of lost soul that graduated from these big Ivy League schools,
really?
Right around bartending. We got there and, all right, maybe we'll stay here. We do something else at the, you know, Valencia Street. So the plans always change.
Yeah.
A year, 2 years into it, we thought I had a deal. Something happened, came in, the deal collapsed again on Brandon Street. We were going to stay there.
Yeah.
You know, nobody moves restaurant three times.
No.
Crazy. So 4 days later, I was in my shower, and I'm like, I'm going to go for it. At the time, Ferry Building, I was going to do a little noodle shop. No one wanted to take the space. They never asked me to do big space. You know, they asked the big boys, like Michael Deller and Pat Coletto, all the big restaurateurs. Me, it's like I'm the little guy.
Yeah.
And finally, I went over there, and I said, I want this whole corner. You got 48 hours to come back to me and say yes to this list of thing I want. And they say, okay. And evidently I find out that a big firm in Chicago owned the building. Who's this guy? Like what? I want to do everything in 4 days. And I couldn't deal with another day because the other deal took me 6 months and it collapsed, you know. So we did it in 3 days, not exactly 2 days, but.
Wow.
So Ferry Building was born. And I had no idea how I'm going to pay for all that stuff. It was just the same thing. And
you go just back to your customer?
I did. I go back to the customer again. And we actually don't have investor at Slandor. It's just all piecemeal together, just friends and family.
And how many years have you been there now?
10 now.
Okay. We have just blown through the program. And it's been fantastic. I have to ask you to come back and do part two. Because I know you have so many ideas and a lot of other things to talk about. So can we call this part one of Charles Fan on Chef's Story? And when I'm in San Francisco, I'll come and visit you.
Sounds
great.
And
we can finish part two. I just want to make a point that there's this new book, Vietnamese Home Cooking by Charles Fan, that you have to go out and buy. Because it really not only gives you his recipes, and I saw shaking beef in there, but he also goes into the equipment, the history, really puts it in context. It's a great and it's beautifully photographed. I wish you luck on it, and I see you soon, Charles. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking, and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to this splendid table wherever you get your podcasts.